Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
Hello. My name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 17th of February, these are our main stories. The leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has said he's prepared to let Russia launch attacks again from his territory. The United Nations is appealing for $1 billion to help victims of the earthquakes in Turkey. And President Biden says the objects shot down over North America in recent days appear to have nothing to do with China. Also in this podcast...
I would say that the route towards Yemen is less visible worldwide. But in fact, it's one of the most dangerous ones because there is a very strong network of traffickers and smugglers.
We look at one of the world's most dangerous migration routes. When Vladimir Putin ordered Russian forces into Ukraine almost a year ago, he used Belarus as a launch pad to attack Kyiv. Now, the Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko has said he's ready to let Moscow use his country again to launch a new offensive. He was speaking to a small group of foreign journalists in Minsk. Among them was our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg.
Few people know Vladimir Putin as well as Alexander Lukashenko does. Today in Minsk, the authoritarian leader of Belarus did something that President Putin hasn't done since invading Ukraine. He took questions from the Western media. 1 year ago, I say to Mr. Lukashenko, you let Russia use your country as a staging ground for the invasion of Ukraine. Are you prepared to do so again? Yes, he replied, I'm ready to do that. I'm even prepared to wage war alongside the Russians, but only if Belarus is attacked first. Mr. Lukashenko accused the West of fueling the war in Ukraine and warned that the conflict could turn nuclear. Then, the leader who had facilitated Russia's invasion claimed he knew how to secure peace. With President Biden expected in Poland next week, Mr. Lukashenko said he'd invite the US president to Belarus and he'd persuade Putin to come too. We'll sit down and reach an agreement, he said. That is unlikely to happen. In the eyes of the West, Mr. Lukashenko is very much in Russia's camp and doing the Kremlin's bidding.
Steve Rosenberg. Well, meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said he won't engage with any peace talks with President Putin because he can't be trusted. And as he told our World Affairs editor John Simpson in Kyiv, he's unwilling to concede any territory to Russia.
After just under a year of war, President Zelensky seems to be in no mood to look for compromise. Ukraine's successes in the fighting and the promises of more weaponry from Western countries mean he doesn't think he needs to offer concessions to Russia. Any territorial compromises, he told me, are only going to weaken our country. Therefore, it's not about compromise. We make millions of compromises every day. But the question is, with Putin? No. Because we don't trust him.
Компроміс з Путіним? Ні.
I last interviewed President Zelensky in October, when Ukraine had its back to the wall. He was noticeably more defiant today.
Я вважаю, що атаки зараз вже йдуть.
Attacks are going on from several directions, he said. Our defense is holding. We need powerful modern weapons. They're the only language Russia understands. We're responding in their language, he said. And when I asked him about the threat that Vladimir Putin might attack Ukraine through neighboring Belarus...
And it will be a big mistake for him and for Belarus. It will be a historical mistake.
But if Belarus does involve itself with the...
We'll fight.
Can you survive?
We'll fight. We will survive. We will survive.
Clearly, Mr. Zelensky's trips to the US, to Britain and to Europe have given him extra confidence.
John Simpson in Kiev. Help is still urgently needed for the huge numbers left without food, heat or shelter after the February the 6th earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. On Thursday, the United Nations launched a $1 billion humanitarian appeal to help people in Turkey. Earlier this week, a $400 million appeal was made for the victims in Syria. Stéphane Dujarric is spokesman for the UN Secretary General.
Now is the time for the world to support the people of Turkey. The needs, as you can imagine, are enormous, the Secretary General said, and people are suffering. There is no time to lose. He urged the international community to step up and fully fund this critical effort in response to one of the biggest natural disasters of our times.
The United Nations has faced criticism for the initial absence of aid. However, if you're in Turkey, too much criticism of the aid effort can get you into trouble. Police there have arrested 20 people for social media posts about the earthquakes, saying that the messages were provocative. President Erdogan has repeatedly criticised the spread of fake news since the earthquake struck. Owen Bennett-Jones spoke to Sue Bolongoris, who is a programme officer for the Europe and Central Asia team of Article 19, a free speech campaigning organisation.
People in Turkey have been using Twitter as one of the main platforms to coordinate rescue efforts and ask for help. But also, at the same time, government criticism on the platform increased and information exchange unfolded the shortcomings of the government's response to the earthquake. So we have been receiving some reports of detention of journalists as well as ordinary social media users. For example, incitement to hatred or even insulting the president. Some of the messages that they were sharing is just related to government's response to the earthquake. For example, just an ordinary young woman last Thursday was arrested for insulting the president. She was released afterwards, but she will be prosecuted for insulting the president in the coming months. This kind of content have been shared on Twitter.
Yes, right. And I think one of the problems was that the government closed down Twitter, which upset people, the rescuers, who were trying to use it to coordinate, as you say, their work.
Exactly, exactly. So Twitter is one of the main platforms people have been using to coordinate rescue efforts and ask for help, sometimes even from under the rubble. And lots of lives were saved by use of locations and information shared on Twitter. And on the day that the government blocked access to Twitter, there were still tens of thousands of people under the rubble, and some of them were still alive. And also those who survived, but still struggling in freezing temperatures without sufficient help, were also using social media to call for help. So it was blocking access to Twitter in such crucial time, firstly disrupted rescue efforts, as many were relying on the information shared on the platform. Secondly, it was hugely detrimental for the coordination of emergency help to hundreds of thousands of survivors who have been waiting for help. We had also seen news that people had to wait without food or water or other sufficient supplies. So it was hugely problematic.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, to be fair, that there have been cases of, you know, of fraud online, phishing scams, where people are basically trying to cheat donors out of money, you know, saying it's for charity when they're just nicking it.
One of the pretexts that government uses is they stated that it was to prevent disinformation as well as fraud. But this is disproportionate and incompatible with international human rights law, because as much as governments restrict access to social media platforms as in these kind of crucial moments, we have seen that both disinformation and other fraudulent content can be shared more widely as people are having harder time to access accurate information.
How many people do you know are in detention for this at the moment? How many actually are being chased by the authorities?
According to the police department, as of today, in total, 330 people now are facing judicial proceedings against them. And 110 people were taken custody and 21 of them were detained pending trial. These are all for over sharing provocative posts on Twitter or other social media platforms.
Sue Bolongoris. There have been angry exchanges between the US and China over the past week or so after the Americans shot down what they said was a Chinese spy balloon. Now, President Biden has said three mysterious objects which were subsequently shot down in North American airspace appear to have had nothing to do with China. Speaking to reporters, he said he'd asked for sharper rules about how suspicious objects should be dealt with in future.
We have to keep adapting our approach to dealing with these challenges. That's why I've directed my team to come back to me with sharper rules for how we will deal with these unidentified objects moving forward, distinguishing between those that are likely to pose safety and security risks that necessitate action and those that do not. But make no mistake, if any object presents a threat to the safety and security of the American people, I will take it down.
Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher listened to President Biden's remarks. So what more did he have to say about those three unidentified objects?
He said that they appeared benign, which means they were not spying in the sky and not related to China. He said they were most likely tied to private companies or research recreation institutions, but that the U.S. could not afford the possibility at the time that they might have been engaged in surveillance, and also that they were flying low enough to be a risk to civilian planes, which is the legal justification for shooting them down. But as you heard, he also said he was looking for sharper rules to determine which flying objects were threats and which weren't.
Now, these incidents have raised tensions with China. Did Mr. Biden sound conciliatory at all?
He said that the U.S. did not want a Cold War and that his diplomats continued to speak with their Chinese counterparts. They wanted to stay engaged. We've been hearing that from the State Department as well. He also said that he would be speaking to China's President Xi Jinping to get to the bottom of this balloon episode, and that he also believed the last thing Mr. Xi wanted was to fundamentally rip the relationship with the U.S. So he emphasized that the incident sort of underscored or enhanced the need for communication to be better, to keep open lines of communication.
There was quite a lot of criticism leveled at Mr. Biden, wasn't there? Will this be enough to silence his critics or all those seeking more information about these objects?
It may be enough to silence some of them. There was a criticism that the administration wasn't being transparent enough, and there was just a lot of confusion, especially amongst the public, about how this happened in the space of a week that four objects had been shot down out of the sky. So what Mr. Biden said later was that he didn't hold a press conference earlier because he wanted more information that those three mysterious objects were, in fact, not a threat. So he held off with a press conference till then. So that may satisfy some people. To the extent that his critics were political, and a lot of the loudest criticism came from Republican lawmakers, it may not be enough.
That was Barbara Plett-Usher. In Serbia, police have arrested three members of a far-right vigilante group just a day after a nationalist rally in Belgrade threatened riots if Serbia accepts a Western-backed plan aimed at mending ties to Kosovo. Media in Belgrade are reporting that among those arrested is the leader of People's Patrol, an organisation which boasts of links to Russia's Wagner mercenary army and has previously organised several rallies to support Russia's war in Ukraine. In contrast to the rest of Europe, support for Russia is widespread in Serbia. Joe Inwood visited Serbia to find out why.
It's a clear, crisp morning in central Belgrade. It's bitingly cold, and there's a trio of buskers playing a rather beautiful song. We're on our way to go meet a man called Vlado. He's just been released from prison, having been convicted for fighting for the Russians in Ukraine. And he has an almost fanatical devotion to the Russian cause. Indeed, he has a rather special name for President Putin.
Tsar Putin. Tsar.
He calls him Tsar Putin. He's wearing a T-shirt bearing his face with the slogan, "Everything is going according to plan" on it. He sees Vladimir Putin as an almost messianic figure, leader of all Slavic people.
I would do anything for Mother Serbia and Mother Russia. They are the same thing.
Vlado is an extreme pan-Slavist, believing that Serbs and Russians are the same people. That devotion led him to the battlefields of Ukraine. While the numbers as fanatical as Vlado are low, he is representative of a more widespread support for Russia. Walking through Belgrade, you can see signs of that support everywhere, whether it's bits of graffiti, you see Zs, or on souvenir stands. I've come to meet Alexander Yerkovich. He's an MP from a right-wing, a nationalist party, and we've met in the shadow of a ruined building.
To je zgrada koja je pogođena tokom NATO bombardovanja, to je zgrada radio televizije Srbije.
It was the Serbian Radio and Television Center, the headquarters, that was hit in a NATO strike in 1999. He thinks the popularity of Russia is more to do with political pragmatism than pan-Slavic ideology.
We have to understand that Russia is a country who supports Serbia in other ways, example in UN, to protect Kosovo and protect Serbian integrity, and the people of Serbia understand that, and appreciate that effort from Russian side.
Although it's fair to say many people disagree.
It is like you put a drug dealer among children and do nothing.
Chedomir Stojkovic is a leading lawyer who campaigns against what he sees as Moscow's interference in his country.
For 15 years, Russians put agents here, money here. They conduct huge operation in the intelligence service. They start to buying some media and to buying news editors. And through that, after war in Ukraine start, they start to conduct brainwashing of Serbian nation.
He argues Russian interference makes an already tense situation worse. Fights recently broke out in parliament over proposals to normalize relations with Kosovo. As for the causes of Russian influence, the truth is all of these things interact. Russia has utilized, some would say weaponized, its historical links with Serbia, building influence and putting pressure on the government in Belgrade. That builds on the simmering resentment towards the West and NATO, which in turn feeds into more support for Russia.
Joe Inwood reporting. Still to come in this podcast.
We found a complete mess, sadly, and this mess is very much present everywhere.
The study taking a closer look at claims about baby formula. The authorities in Somalia say they've killed 300 militants from the Al-Shabaab group in the south of the country. It's the latest setback for the militants, who've lost swathes of territory in recent months following an offensive by the Somali military backed by African Union troops. Emmanuel Igunza reports from Nairobi.
The Somali government says the operation in Hishabele province was supported by airstrikes involving international partners. The US regularly assists Somali federal forces in fighting the militants. Al-Shabaab has yet to comment. The jihadists have recently been losing control of swathes of territory in central and southern Somalia, pushed back by government forces and allied clan militia backed by African Union troops. Last month, President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud appealed for international support to fight the group. Al-Shabaab, however, continues to carry out attacks, including in the capital Mogadishu and in neighboring countries such as Ethiopia and Kenya.
Emmanuel Igunza. In the past week alone, the government in Djibouti says it has rescued over 380 Ethiopians from a boat that was capsizing. They were on their way to Yemen. The migration route through the Gulf is one of the world's most dangerous, according to the International Organization for Migration. Yet the majority of people begin the perilous journeys in search of a better life abroad and are oblivious of what lies along the way. The organization's Director General, Antonio Vitorino, spoke to the BBC's Anne Soy in Nairobi about just how bad the situation is.
I would say that the route towards Yemen is less visible worldwide. But in fact, it's one of the most dangerous ones because there is a very strong network of traffickers and smugglers, criminal organized crime that operates there. But of course, we consider other very deadly routes like Central Mediterranean. We have the figures of last year, more than 105,000 people arrived in Italy. But we also could consider the Atlantic route, from the west coast of Africa to the Canary Islands, which is also a very dangerous one, and where it is much more difficult to estimate how many people died. But if you look to other places in the world, like, for instance, the jungle between Colombia and Panama, you have another example of a very dangerous route. So one of the key issues that was discussed in New York in the International Migration Review Forum was precisely what can countries do to reduce the danger of these trips.
What can they do?
Yes, first of all, I think that there is a need to be effective in identifying and prosecuting the criminal networks that violate the most basic human rights of the migrants by trafficking and smuggling them. And secondly, this requires not just effective border controls, but above all, cooperation among the law enforcement agencies, particularly the police and the prosecutions.
Based on your report from last year, mm-hmm. there's a lot of migration, legal migration from countries like India, mm-hmm. China, you know, people going to Europe and North America, and it's not a problem. So what is it with African countries and, you know, even countries in the Middle East that, you know, are lower income countries?
And first of all, we think that one of the critical measures to fight against irregular migration is to open legal, regular pathways. Let me be very clear. I'm not saying that regular pathways will put an end to irregular migration. No. But what I would say is that having more regular pathways will reduce the pressure for migrants to look after other alternatives like irregular migration and trafficking, being trafficked.
What's exacerbating the situation?
I think that we can speak each time of more and more of socioeconomic conditions, loss of livelihoods, looking for opportunities for a better life. But each time more and more conflict and instability, definitely. And more relevant even in these last few years is the impact of climate change in human mobility. People are forced to be displaced, some places because of drought, in other places because of floods, because of extreme weather, typhoons, cyclones, landslides. So we are witnessing a number of drivers that interact and function as drivers for migration.
Antonio Vitorino speaking to Anne Soy. Now to Spain, where the Parliament has given final approval to a new law which will make it easier for people to change their legally recognised gender. All that will be needed for those aged over 16 to change the details on national identity cards is a simple declaration. Previously, confirmation of gender dysphoria and, in some cases, 2 years of hormone therapy was needed. Spain's Equality Minister, Irene Montero, backs the law.
It's a law that also recognises rights for trans children, rights that were at risk during the debate over this law, rights that I am aware could go further. But today we take a giant step so that trans children feel more understood in their schools, by their families, and that those families have more support and that they find understanding where there was previously derision.
Activists in Spain have called the law an important step towards establishing equality, but it has proved controversial, as Eleanor Sly reports.
The bill, which was approved by Spanish lawmakers, makes it easier and faster for people in Spain to change their legally registered gender. It makes Spain one of the few nations to let people alter the gender on their identity card with a simple declaration, removing the need for psychological and medical evaluation. The process could in theory take as little as 4 months. Those who are under the age of 16 will be required to have parental permission to make the change. The law has created both political and ideological divisions within the left-wing government of Pedro Sanchez. It has also drawn a backlash from a number of critics, including some feminists, who say it risks making women unsafe in single-sex spaces such as swimming pools and prisons.
Eleanor Sly. When parents or carers are looking for baby formula, they'll see a lot of claims about how any particular brand benefits development and growth. But new research on products and marketing around the world suggests there's little evidence to back up the claims. Dr. Daniel Munblit is a senior co-author for the study from Imperial College London.
The reasoning for doing this study is because both mothers and healthcare professionals and researchers are facing the same problem all around the world with infant formula promoting particular claims. And these claims are very flashy. They're very attractive for the population. We wanted to see what are the claims that are commonly used across the world in low-resource settings, in high-income countries, and eventually came up with an understanding that everything is very similar. So these very similar claims are used, and there are some typical claims they use all around the world. Then we looked at which ingredients are mentioned in relation to a particular claim. And we also looked at scientific referencing. So what is the scientific evidence behind these claims?
And so what did you find?
We found a complete mess, sadly. And this mess is very much present everywhere. And sadly, infant formula industry does not provide references to the claims. So they do not provide you with scientific evidence which should support this claim that they make. So approximately around 75% of claims are not supported by the relevant reference. And even when clinical trials are cited, the vast majority of them are associated with high risk of bias.
Now, presumably, some regions and some countries are better at protecting parents from inflated claims or misinformation than others.
Yeah, that's true. I would say the problem is quite significant worldwide, but apparently in countries like US and Russia, the landscape is much worse than in other places.
Now, obviously, breastfeeding doesn't work for all mothers, and it is important to be clear, isn't it, that none of this stuff actually does any harm, does it?
No, it doesn't make any harm per se. Sometimes researchers doing this kind of studies or this kind of analysis are portrayed as people fighting infant formula industry and trying to ban infant formula. And that's not the case. So there always will be children whose mothers cannot breastfeed or they choose not to breastfeed. So I think that we are aiming for plain packaging.
With no claims, but obviously we'd need to have ingredients, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, there are some mandatory regulations and obviously listing ingredients is of an utmost importance. If any claim is made with regards to ingredient, if it is based on solid evidence saying that there is ingredient X which is essential for brain development or essential for cognitive development or for anything else, it should be mandatory part of absolutely any infant formula. Otherwise, babies would be discriminated. However, if a particular ingredient is not associated with a strong evidence, is not backed up with a strong evidence with regards to a particular health claim, then this claim should not be made. In the real world, it's impossible for parents to spend days and weeks investigating whether every claim is true or not. But with the vast majority of claims being misleading, I would suggest not looking that much at the claims and trying to persuade policymakers to make this change for plain packaging to be introduced worldwide to eliminate this problem of health claims made by the industry.
Dr. Daniel Munblit. In December 2019, the lives of one family changed forever. 29-year-old Aaron Wilson was hit by two cars while crossing the road in central England and died from his injuries a few days later. His family decided to donate his organs, and that changed the lives of six other families. His mother, Irene, said that it was something Aaron would have wanted. Irene is now good friends with two of the families, something not often heard of with such cases. Bola Masuro spoke to Irene about her decision and how she felt when she heard from some of the recipients.
Well, we were quite proud, really, to think that people that received his organs actually wanted to get in contact with us. You know, it was a nice feeling to know that they wanted to thank us for what our son did. So it was really nice.
And, I mean, he was so young at the time, 29, I believe, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and
he was.
The lady who received his kidney, it seems like she was around the same age. And the fact that she was able to go on to become a nurse. Could you tell us a little bit about the relationship you've now developed?
Yeah, the young nurse, Gladys, she's kept us informed of her progress through her training. And then the last letter we received, she said that she'd passed a nursing degree and she was now a fully qualified nurse, which was great. And it was through Aaron's kidney that she had another chance at life.
Has it helped you in your grief?
Yes, to a certain extent. What happened to Aaron, I mean, that isn't over yet. The people that were involved won't be tried till the end of May. So we've got that, you know, over us.
You've also now helped so many other people, thousands of others who've now followed your story, because you set up a Facebook page, didn't you?
I mean, after Aaron's death, quite a few of his friends also registered to be organ donors. Me and my husband are organ donors. There is a stigma with it. Nobody talks about it a lot. Something that Aaron's done gives people, like, peace of mind. Well, then, yes, it's a good thing.
Irene Wilson speaking to Bola Masuro. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Eleanor Sly. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, actor Asif Manvi.
Indian people did not go to the theater to see themselves.
Asif shares the story of writing the one-person play, Sakina's Restaurant.
What do you mean there's a play about me and my experience?
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.